You are listening to Prometheus by a Minute. I'm your host, Courtney Colson. This is Minute 6. This minute opens with the title card and ends with Charlie shouting, "What?" I mentioned in a previous minute that Ridley Scott is the master of the setup, payoff, minute structure, and I think this minute is a good example of that. Early in this minute, Elizabeth says, "Get Charlie," and it ends with him responding to that, a conclusion, but also a bridge to the next minute. Let's analyze the name of the film, considering that it is on the screen in the opening of this minute. In an interview with The Hollywood Reporter, Ridley Scott says he named the film Prometheus, seeing the name aptly fit the film's themes. It's a story of creation, the gods, and the man who stood against them. In Greek mythology, the titan Prometheus was an immortal servant of the gods, who stole and gave to mankind the gift of godfire, an immeasurable benefit that changed the human race forever, for better or worse. It made mankind dangerous to the gods. A link to that interview will be in the footnotes. That final statement, mankind being dangerous to the gods, is of particular interest, a possible motivation for the gods abandoning mankind. Fear of the creation ties in nicely with the Miltonian Frankenstein themes of this story, so it makes sense, but why do they reject us? Is it simply because we surpassed them, behaving in ways they didn't expect or couldn't control? It's fun to speculate, although I do worry that my imagination has devised something that is totally different to what we may get when this trilogy wraps up. We see our first human, Elizabeth Shaw. Her hair is different here. This wig can be seen in some of the featurettes on the Blu-ray. The cut is basically the same, you know, short with a fringe, but it's dead straight, and I can't imagine she was bothering to do anything with her hair while she was working on a dig site. Shaw is a practical woman. There's no way of knowing what order they shot the film in, but I gather this was early in the process and they simply changed their minds on the hairstyle. The other possibility is that it's to show the passage of time, but she has long brown hair in the Quiet Eye video, one of the viral marketing videos. So, I don't know, I just think this might be a continuity error. Though it is interesting to watch the featurette where they were trying to figure out her look. It's a nice insight into the process of costume on film in general. They just tried so many different outfits. Obviously, they had some kind of wardrobe. They were hiring out different things and what have you. And yeah, they had different wigs and very different costumes. And it's funny, Ridley at first just being proposed the idea of red hair, he's like, "Oh, no, definitely no." And then they tried the red wig we see in this minute and went, "Oh, actually, I quite like that." I quite prefer the style they went with for the rest of the film. You know, it's something a bit more looser, unstructured. It's more timeless, I feel. Whereas this particular haircut is very, it even looks dated now. So that was 2012, and I already feel like it's such a mid-2000s overly blow-dried look. Elizabeth speaks the first line of dialogue when she says, "Get Charlie." Not quite as rich with subtext as the opening lines of Covenant. "How do you feel? Alive." I mean, that's the entire thesis of the film right there. This is a very understated introduction to our heroine. Then again, our introduction to Ripley was so underplayed that it's not even apparent she's the lead until about halfway into Alien. But we are seeing Elizabeth in her element, and it flows nicely from the previous scene and into the next. It's not so much about singling out these characters as it is efficiently setting up the story. Filmed in Scotland, this is one of the rare glimpses of Earth in the Alien universe. It seems beautiful and pristine, but maybe this location is just very remote, away from the dystopian cities. The only other times we see Earth is in a deleted scene in Covenant, where Daniels is looking out of her apartment window into the cityscape. It's hard to tell much of anything based on that tiny glimpse. The other scene is the end of Alien 4, showing an apocalyptic Paris. As the film takes place so far into the future, it doesn't have much bearing on Prometheus anyway. I don't even think that ending was in the original cut either. Once again, the humans are dressed in contemporary, practical, timeless clothing. Brightly coloured North Face jackets that contrast nicely against the dark green-grey scenery. Janty Yates clearly takes a location into account when dressing the actors. You'd think that would be obvious, but not all productions seem to pay that much attention. I think that's one of the reasons Alien has stood the test of time. They aren't wearing these crazy sci-fi costumes, they're all dressed in blue-collar uniforms. Function is the priority. I have to wonder if Star Trek would have been the same if they had simply worn military uniforms or something like that. Speaking of, although Stargate isn't that old, the costumes certainly play it safe. I think you could watch the show a century from now and not find the SG-1 costumes distracting. And yes, there I go again, mentioning Star Trek and Stargate. But they do share common DNA in terms of space exploration stories. Costumes might not be something most people pay close attention to, but they really influence how we respond and relate to a character, even if it is on a subconscious level. There's a certain goofiness to most of the Star Trek uniforms, whereas the crew of the Nostromo, or SG-1, read as familiar to us, even if they are in a fantastic world. This is not to say that we can't relate to characters in elaborate fantasy costumes, of course. If it is a fantasy world, then everything is heightened. But in the Alien universe, the whole point is that it feels real, even mundane. That's what makes it scary. It's hard to find something scary when there's no connection to reality. We soon get our introduction to Charlie. Many people still think this is Tom Hardy, like they were absolutely convinced that Tom Hardy was in Prometheus. I mean, they do look pretty similar. I am glad that Charlie and Elizabeth are close in age. Logan is 3 years older than Noomi. Originally, they were going to have this romantic student-teacher dynamic, with Shaw having studied under Holloway. I think there's about a 20-year age gap. Now, there's nothing explicitly wrong with that, but I just don't like that power imbalance. She is Holloway's equal, and if you ask me, superior. Having a couple in the crew does help to invest the audience emotionally. Covenant, of course, does this to great effect. While we don't get much time with all of those characters, when one of them dies, my mind always went to their partner and wondered how they would deal with this. Time for our recurring segment of reading the script. I think I will read entire scenes from here on out rather than just sections. It just makes them easier to follow, because there often isn't a one-to-one adaptation. This scene is quite different in the final version, and I think budget was a main motivation behind these changes. On black. Drifting motes of light against the dark. A starscape. An excavator floats into view. A sturdy vehicle equipped with robotic arms. Bright floodlights beat at the darkness. Inside the cockpit, a bubble of glass, sits a beautiful woman. This is Dr. Jocelyn Watts, 32, a precocious scholar of many disciplines. A scientist accustomed to fieldwork. The cockpit is sweltering. She wears shorts, boots, a t-shirt, and still her arms and legs gleam with sweat. Watts works the controls. The excavator descends towards a rocky surface. Silt billows up as the excavator approaches. We're not in space at all, but deep underwater. The excavator's thrust is a cowled propellers. The stars are plankton shining in the hoodlights. Interior. Excavator. Continuous. Watts steers the excavator to a steeply sloping cliff wall. A sea trench yawns below her, its depth lost in darkness. Watts. Moving to survey Site B, closing on Object 4, the large oblong. She watches a screen of a ground-penetrating radar system, a bright signal return. Something hidden in the cliff in front of her, something big. Watts continued, there you are. Exterior, trench, continuous. Watts carves into the cliff with the excavator's digger arm. Silt and boulders fall into the yawning trench below. She brings a water cannon to bear, uses its jet to blast away loose silt and stones. The cliff face collapses, a muddy landslide into the depths. Watts backs away from the collapse, thrusters whirring to keep her out of the turbulence, a cloud of silt clears. In her floodlight beams, the obelisk stands revealed, its outlines worn by age, easily 30 feet tall. Watts stares at the obelisk, stunned. Her voice is husky. Martin, here. A second excavator glides out of the dark. At the controls, Professor Martin Holloway, 48, visionary genius and archaeologist, dark-haired and lean, with rangy build of a frontiersman. He's dressed in work trousers and a t-shirt, stubbly chin. He plays his floodlights over the obelisk. Holloway, look at that. Interior, Watts excavator. Watts floats her excavator down the front of the obelisk, scanning the alien text. Suddenly, she stops, grips the obelisk with her excavator's arms to anchor herself in place. Watts, you need to see this. Holloway, coming. Exterior, sea trench. Holloway pilots his excavator expertly up to Watts, mates the two vehicles at their aft hatchways. Interior, Watts excavator. Behind Watts, a hatch opens with a splatter of water. Holloway climbs in, squeezes into her cockpit, a tight fit. He's distracted by her body, pressed so close, but she has eyes only for the inscrutable writing outside the glass. Watts, same thing again. Holloway, what do you see? Watts, an ephemeris, a star map. Radius, inclination, azimuth, more data here. Holloway, if we can get Epoch and Equinox out of that, Watts, can we raise this thing? Holloway shakes his head, hundreds of tons. Exterior, Mediterranean Sea, day. A research vessel at anchor on a turquoise sea, bright sun. In the distance, a coastline dotted with villas. The horizon is dominated by the volcanic peak, the same peak we saw in the distance in the prologue. Aboard the research vessel, cranes lift Watts and Holloway's excavators out of the sea and onto the deck. Interior, research vessel, aft deck, day. Under an awning, prints of the obelisk's faces are stretched on the deck, 15 feet long. Watts and Holloway crawl over the alien text, red markers in hand, passing, translating, calculating. They're tanned, fit, the wind in their hair, the Mediterranean coast in the distance. It's an idyllic way to work, but they're utterly absorbed in the task at hand. Aft deck, night. They're still at it. Lights illuminate the workspace. The obelisk prints are blanketed with markings and annotations. Holloway sits at a table. Watts sits on the marked-up prints. Both work through calculations on electronic slates. Holloway looks up. I have a solution. A single match. Watts. Me too. Checked it twice. Holloway. You first. Watts holds up her slate. It displays a set of stellar coordinates. A detailed map. Holloway holds his own slate. An exact match. They lock eyes in electric excitement. Watts. What do we do now? Holloway. We go there. If this had been directed by James Cameron, you can bet this scene would have stayed exactly as it was, and probably would have been filmed on location too. He does love himself a bit of the ocean. And it is quite an exciting scene, but ultimately unnecessary and would have slowed the film down. Also, I don't like how sexualized the whole thing is, but it is interesting to think the obelisk was made by engineers and not humans. That changes things a bit. It's, again, drawing closer parallels to 2001 A Space Odyssey. Now, I'll go into more detail about the cave paintings when they show up in the next minute. Having the art created by humans versus created by engineers really implies a totally different story. I'm curious to know why they changed Shaw and Holloway's names. It's pretty common in the process of any movie that little aesthetic changes will be made, but why did they go, yeah, Jocelyn Watts is not working, so Elizabeth Shaw is preferable? Other than it being a Doctor Who reference, I don't really know what the thought process was there. And same with changing Martin to Charlie. Does one sound younger? I don't really know. I'd be curious to know what went on behind the scenes there, but I guess that will forever remain a mystery. If you're wondering, the Lindelof script is very close to the final film, though it is quite fun to read because it sounds like an excitable child recapping a story to you, complete with sound effects. Here's an example. Fwosh! We are carried over the waterfall, dropping and dropping and dropping until we crash into a pool beneath. Or, we are literally at the microscopic level. it's fun, but overall not really worth exploring on this show because it's essentially the movie we got. The engineer script is fascinating though because, as I've mentioned, some fans think of it as superior to the movie. Plus, it gives us a greater insight into the development of this world and the ideas. Alright, that about covers it. This is Colson signing off. You can find me on traviandesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook. Bailey. Come on, buddy. Come on, old man. There we go. Okay. Hi. You're very cute. Focusing on my podcast, I am a professional.